all the Muslims, Allah does not want to force His people to fast. We must learn how to preach Islam from the Holy Quran. Four of the important commands of Islam were established 15 years after the advent of Islam. These four deeds include paying khums and paying zakat, jihad, and fasting. This is a big lesson for us. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qarati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Muslims across the world have spent the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan marking Al-Quds Day. The day was designated by Imam al-Khomeini, who commanded Muslims to institute this day in order to always keep the cause of Palestine fresh in the hearts and minds of Muslims everywhere. This episode will discuss Al-Quds Day, in particular in the context of the extra importance it takes with regards to the current genocidal war Israel is waging on the people of Palestine. First, we take a look at the ideology of Imam al-Khomeini with regards to Palestine and what drove him to institute Al-Quds Day.
The Zionist occupation of Palestine was preceded by the injection of the poison of nationalism, a concept totally alien to the Quranic concept of the Ummah, the single faith community. The ideology of Arab nationalism fragmented the Muslim masses when they were confronted by Zionist nationalism in a conflict over control of Palestine, as they could only be mobilized on the basis of Islam, not on the basis of an alien ideology imported from the West. The Western powers pursued a long-term strategy, first defeating the Ottoman Empire and then planting their agents in the fragmented body of the Ummah in the Global South. Muslims ended up with traitorous rulers who were nurtured by the colonialist powers and are therefore loyal to them. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, candidly admitted that the Arab regimes are Israel's first line of defense. These regimes have continued to suppress the Islamic movement. It was in this grim situation that the Islamic Revolution succeeded in Iran in 1979. Soon thereafter, Imam Khomeini, as the first truly Islamic leader to emerge in the Ummah in the post-colonial period, took a number of decisions that had far-reaching implications. The Islamic State severed all links with the Zionist state and expelled its agents from Iran. The Imam then proclaimed that only the mobilization of Muslim masses would liberate the first Qibla of Islam from the clutches of Zionism. Towards this end, he declared that the last Friday of Ramadan should be marked as Yawm al-Quds, the Day of al-Quds, on which Muslims throughout the world should reaffirm their determination and commitment to end the continued occupation of Al-Quds and Palestine by the Zionist invaders. Imam Khomeini located the struggle of the Muslim masses in the very roots of Islam. In the month of Ramadan, where Muslims worldwide not only fast together, but also congregate over the recitation of the Word of God and the remembrance of significant Islamic history and victories like that of Badr. By observing the Day of Al-Quds, Muslims not only begin to fulfill a political obligation, they also acknowledge a religious one. The protection of Islam's sacred places is a duty that is incumbent upon all Muslims. As long as Al-Quds remains in the clutches of Zionism, this duty remains unfulfilled, and mobilizing the Muslim Ummah toward this objective becomes a religious obligation.
Now, to discuss this important topic are two very special guests. We're honored to welcome Masood Shajara. Brother Masood is the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, which organizes legal support for Muslims targeted by the state. The IHRC has been one of the organizers of the annual Quds Day in London for several decades. I'm also honored to welcome back Sister Noor Fekri to the show. Sister Noor is a politics graduate with a keen interest in West Asian affairs. She uses her social media platform to analyze religious and political events in a way that is accessible to the everyday person. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you for joining us here to discuss what is a really momentous day in the Islamic world and wider, actually. Sister Noor, if I could begin with you. Firstly, we just heard there some of the context behind why Imam Khomeini did establish Quds Day, and I wanted to ask you, like, why did he make such efforts? What was he worried about in terms of perhaps Muslims forgetting the importance of Palestine during that era?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I honestly don't think he thought people would forget Palestine. If you look around today and ask people about Palestine, absolutely everyone is aware of what is going on in Palestine. So I think the Imam actually had an incredible ability of basira, being able to see into the future and foresee that actually people will remember. Al-Quds Day then, we could say 40 years ago, could have been established in order to remind people then, because then the Palestine folder had been put onto the shelves, gathering dust. There were peace agreements that were being made, failed Oslo Accords, constant failed agreements, as though you can agree with the colonizer, as though you can negotiate with the colonizer. And people were starting to forget the Palestinian issue. But he brought it back onto the list of priorities. He made it a top priority. He removed the Israeli occupation entity embassy from Tehran and erected a Palestinian embassy. He recognized Palestine as a state, which is significant, as one state recognizing another. And so back then, he made people remember it through Al-Quds Day. However, today, he made it a reoccurring event. So it's something that happens every single Ramadan, which is, by the way, Islam's holiest month, and on a Friday, which is Islam's holiest day, to unite people in the future. It wasn't necessarily to remind them. And through this unity, he attempted to unite Muslims to counter the sectarianism that the West tried to sort of get people to occupy themselves with. So, for instance, they would occupy people's minds by telling them that Palestinians are Sunnis, and why should Shia Lebanese or Shia Iranians or Zaydi Yemenis defend Palestine? So he, with Al-Quds Day, destroyed the idea of sectarianism and united people through the banner of Palestine in Islam.
Absolutely. And Brother Masood, as the sister rightly mentioned there, you know, there have been attempts to, which persist to this day, to stress and focus on sectarian differences maybe that appear. But, the status of Al-Quds is quite central in Islam itself. What is it about Al-Quds exactly that makes it so important to the religion of Islam and to Muslims around the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The obvious is that it was the first Qibla of Muslims and is one of the holiest sites in Islam. But I think it goes far beyond that. I mean, what the sister said is absolutely right about the importance of Al-Quds and why it was instigated. I'm old enough to remember it at the time. At that time, the struggle for freedom of Palestine was being shifted between the East and the West. You know, people were going towards Americans and for trying to get Palestinians free, or another group of people, or a few years later they were going towards communism as a solution. And Imam Khomeini at that time, when there was no single International Day of Remembrance of plight of the Palestinians, establish Al-Quds Day as an Islamic solution to the problems of region. And I think that was really significant, because it sort of clarified, and it's even the significant of it right now is the same, that yes, it is this holy place, yes, it's very important, but what is the solution? The solution is resistance. The solution is actually removal of Zionism and oppression as an ideology, and the solution needs to be defined by the people who are living there. And I think this is what makes Al-Quds Day even very important now, because what we are saying very clearly, that people in Palestine, the oppressed people, people who are facing the greatest genocide of our time, have got the right and indeed the duty to resist against it under international law, under any moral values or basis. And that is the solution. And the solution at end of it is remove, not just, just make Israel a smaller place or larger place. Mm. Actually, like South Africa, the apartheid needs to be removed. Mm. Apartheid cannot be reformed. And that is the basis of this. And I think it's very important that this voice is heard every year at the month of Ramadan, because it's an Islamic solution that actually gives platform to not just Muslims fighting others. It's actually giving empowerment to Muslims, Christians and others to become the masters of their future in occupied Palestine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Ramadan element is so important, and it highlights the basira of Imam al-Khomeini, because it's when Muslims are most engaged and focused on the communal aspect and maybe have a higher sense of spiritualism.
I mean, if you actually think that the whole month we fast to become a better human being.
Yeah, exactly.
And if we look at this this sort of state, which is not just endangering Palestinians, but endangering humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, for God's sake, this is not just about saving Palestinians. If we go down this route of legitimizing these genocide, the whole of the humanity is at danger. And I think if the whole month of Ramadan, we don't think about this, we don't find a solution to this, we don't become part of that solution, then what's the point of fasting the whole
absolutely.
Month?
Sister Noor, how does Al-Quds Day take extra significance this year in particular?
I think it takes extra significance for obvious reasons. I mean, there's a literal genocide taking place, even thinking about what they're doing to the Palestinian people. I mean, I can't stop trembling thinking about them bombing buildings and killing babies, and it's just incredibly disgusting. It is out of this world disgusting what they're doing to the Palestinian people. So I think naturally this year is going to be extra significant for us, because we're going to be with Palestine in our hearts, minds and prayers. But when we're talking about sort of the significance of Al-Quds Day in general, I think Brother Masoud really touched on the idea of resistance. It is the slogan, Al-Quds is the slogan of the resistance movement. If you think about Iran, for example, they have a branch of their military called Al-Quds Force. The Lebanese, they call themselves martyrs for Al-Quds. The Yemenis, you know, they've been bombing US ships in the sea all for Al-Quds. So it really unites people. But I think when we're talking about the significance this year, the main important point that I've really realized is this shift in narrative from people. And we were seeing influencers like Subhi, I'm sure you've seen him on Instagram, who has hundreds of thousands of followers. And his post went viral where he said, you know what, I support the resistance. Enough is enough of us sort of setting empty Free Palestine chants with nothing to back it up. And I think that's really what Al-Quds Day stands for. Mm. It stands for the people that really support resistance. And that's what's becoming prominent. People want to join that caravan of truth this year. They don't want to be left behind.
Mm, absolutely. And it's probably for that reason why Al-Quds Day is targeted the way it is. In that context, we could take a look at some of the Al-Quds Days of years gone by and look at the incidents of violence and oppression that have been meted out against those believers who attend these events.
Ever since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan has been designated as Quds Day as per the orders of the late Imam Khomeini. But the day has seen a number of major incidents take place, as it has become a target for tyrants, Zionists and terrorists the world over. In 1985, during the Iran-Iraq War, Iranians were commemorating Quds Day in Iran when bombers and long-range missiles sent by Saddam's regime struck 14 Iranian cities, killing at least 78 people. In 2010, in Quetta, Pakistan, a suicide bomber attacked Pakistani Shias holding a Quds Day rally. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, which killed at least 65 people and wounded 160. In 2012, as the Persian Gulf Kingdom of Bahrain was roiled by ongoing anti-government protests, that year's Quds Day was also met with deadly force by British-trained security forces, and one man was killed. Then in 2014 came one of the most pivotal events in the history of Al-Quds Day. In Zaria, Nigeria, where the leader of the Islamic movement, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, is based, the Nigerian army opened fire on the Quds Day rally and killed 35 people, including three of Sheikh Zakzaki's sons. This was followed by another massacre the following year that killed over 1,000 followers of the Islamic movement, including another three of the Sheikh's sons, and led to the kidnapping of him and his wife and hundreds of other followers by the Nigerian regime. Despite the targeting of those who attend the annual Quds Day march across the world, the continued presence of millions of people shows both the foresight of Imam Khomeini and the enduring nature of the cause of Al-Quds in the hearts.
Now, Brother Masoud, we heard about some examples there. Can you expand on a few of those examples of Muslims and others being, you know, attacked and killed on this specific day?
Yes, I think the fact of the matter is that it's been targeted, by the Zionists, targeted by those who actually want to undermine the empowerment of Muslims to rise up against this one of the institutions of Zionism, which is actually killing and committing all these crimes. Zaria sort of attack was horrible. I went to Zaria just after that attack and investigated. It was said that three of the sheikh's children were killed in that attack. One was killed in that attack. Two of them were picked up and assassinated in an army base afterward, and many others who died out of 28 were killed deliberately, assassinated. You know, we don't have to go far. Osborne, who attacked an individual outside Finsbury Park Mosque, he came to London targeting Al-Quds Day, and he actually failed to reach the Al-Quds demonstration on time, and that's why he changed his plan and targeted the Finsbury Park Mosque. In court hearing, the judge said, "You, a horrible man, came to London to target a demonstration of innocent people, family and children, a peaceful demonstration." So really it's been seen that this demonstration is a demonstration of ordinary people standing up for what is just, what is fair, and what is necessary, because to stop this genocide taking place must be the duty of every one of us. And at the same time, we are seeing that those who are coming to London and elsewhere, they're coming from the Muslim, Christian, Jewish, and indeed secular background. Those who are targeting it is also axis of evil. They're Zionists, they're sort of Iranian pro-Shah, claiming to be democratic and so forth and so on. So it really is what we see very clearly.
And so you mentioned Jewish as well, and that community that come to Al-Quds Day and support Palestine and the Torah Charter, they are a small but vocal group of Jewish clerics, if you will, who support the rights of the Palestinian people. They've also been attacked within their own community.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember one of the rabbis was punched so violently, and he was bleeding quite, and the police was doing nothing about it. and they're being attacked day in, day out. I think I have to say this. It's not just rabbis. Mm. There's a huge number of Jewish community that's coming forward. And they're really the heroes of the time, because it's not easy for them to come out and say, not in our name. You know, it really is, it goes against all the publicity and propaganda which been done. And they're being targeted themselves. They've been arrested in being anti-Semitic, you know, and so forth and so on. So really, I think we need to recognize the bravery of everyone that is coming on a day like this to stand for what is right, what is just, and what is necessary to end this evil of genocide that is taking place.
Absolutely. Sister Noor, the British regime has been talking about cracking down on the pro-Palestinian movement and protests in general. This is an attempt that obviously thus far has failed miserably. It's seen Suella Braverman, the previous Home Secretary, lose her job. Do you expect there to be a rise in attempts to ban Al Quds Day going forward?
I mean, they've attempted to ban it every single year. They've come up with nonsense to ban every single year. First it's a political movement, then it's a flag, then it's the colour of the flag. They've come with something new to ban every single year, and they will attempt to ban Al-Quds Day in particular. I mean, we should ask ourselves, why is it that they have take such issue with Al-Quds Day? Why do they not mind? I mean, we've had over 12 Saturdays in a row of national Palestine demos with at some point reaching almost a million people in attendance. And they didn't seem to have an issue with that. I mean, they did say, you know, their hate marches, etc., but they didn't try to ban it. With Al-Quds Day, they take particular sort of interest in banning that because they know that it represents resistance. And when we talk about resistance, it represents the type of resistance like the resistance in Lebanon that pushed back the Israeli occupation entity 7 kilometers back into the occupied territory, occupied Palestinian territory. It destroyed over, you know, 1,000 of their sort of intelligence apparatus on the border. We're talking about the resistance in Yemen that, you know, their honorable slippers have, you know, they've fought in their slippers and they've bombed ships in the sea. And so it's that type of resistance that stands in the face of these arrogant powers that they fear so badly. I mean, we're looking at the reality on the ground. The Israeli occupation entity has lost the war. They've lost. We're just waiting for that ceasefire to happen so that we can all go out and celebrate. The point is, the US is so worried about this burden that they now have, which is the Israeli occupation entity, and they're trying as hard as they can to just find an end out of this conflict. And it's evident in their confusion. First they vote for a ceasefire, then they don't vote for a ceasefire. They're just confused, and they're going to, once the ceasefire is declared, they're going to slap that genocidal child of theirs, which is the Israeli occupation entity, in the face and discipline it. But in the meantime, they need to find a solution, which is the two-state solution that they keep pushing. And Al-Quds Day and people that come to Al-Quds Day is exactly what opposes that. We don't want no two-state solution. We support resistance. That's what Al-Quds Day is all about.
Absolutely. We were speaking earlier, Brother Masood, about the kind of people that come and oppose Al-Quds Day. Like we said, we've seen those Zionists, we've seen Iranian traitors, if you will, those who are willing to support the people who are attacking and bombing their own country. We've seen these like racist, far-right Zionist groups like the EDL and others in years gone by. Is that not a sign that somebody might be on the right side of history?
Right. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I remember Majid Nawaz, one year, was standing with Al-Quds and saying Israel doesn't have the right of existence. Then, with a bit of a few dollars, they actually managed to get him to go on to their side and to support, and said that Al-Quds should be banned and people who are saying this sort of thing. So, really, I think that is happening, as is clearly pathetic in some ways. 25, 30 of them managing get together to come and oppose and try to force their agenda. Why they do it is very clear. What Al-Quds stand for is not just a peace and hugging or a two-state solution and illusions that has created the genocide of today. Yeah. And what it does is actually address it, gives the, it stands for, as the sister said, for resistance, which is recognized under international law, and sees that is a solution, and the solution comes with defeat of the Zionist ideology, which is creating the problem to start with. The problem with some other demonstration is that you know, we seem to be resetting the time every time, you know, and we forget the whole history and the disease of ideology of Zionism that is creating the problem. You want the solution, you have to get rid of that. We got rid of apartheid in South Africa, people start living their lives together, white, black, and others. In Palestine, occupied Palestine, we want a solution. We have to get rid of Zionism so Jews, Muslims, Christians, and others could begin to have a future. And I think that is what is being opposed. The totality of a solution, not just for that region, but for everywhere else, that you need to get rid of these demonizing ideologies that is putting otherization and putting people against each other to have a future. And I think what's different between, in short, different between Al-Quds demonstration and others is that in Al-Quds demonstration, nobody is waiting in an illusion that the United Nations or the U.S. cavalry is going to come at the 11th hour with the trumpets and save the day for the Palestinians. Palestinians and others have to stand up and through resistance and by their freedom and their dignity.
Absolutely. Sister Noor, just the last question, if you will. Are you planning to attend Al-Quds Day? And if you are, what message would you have for others that perhaps are thinking about going or maybe haven't previously attended in the past?
I mean, I'll tell people that if you've ever been to any other Palestine, pro-Palestine march, and you've gone and you've seen people that are holding FSA flags, or you've seen someone that's calling for a two-state solution, or somebody doesn't even know why they're there, that's common because that's, you know, they don't have an actual goal, whereas Al-Quds Day has a goal. It's pro-resistance, it's pro-solutions, as Brother Masoud has said. So I do encourage everyone to attend Al-Quds Day if you really do want to see a way out of this genocide that is taking place right now.
Absolutely. Thank you to you both for joining us on this important episode about a day and an event which, as we've discussed at length today, is really important in reviving that spirit of the Muslims and focusing on a specific goal, as opposed to, you know, a kind of chaotic approach we've seen, as you just mentioned there, with other protests. So thank you for your time. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd also like to thank you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
One of the key buts on the reported factors of the unwavering U.S. support for the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza is the overwhelming presence of Zionist Jews in the Joe Biden administration. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, these Zionist Jews exert enormous influence in the American power corridors and enjoy unconditional support from the U.S. president, who has on numerous occasions boasted of being a Zionist himself. The presence and influence of Zionist Jews in the White House has always been a point of discussion. However, since the events of October 7th, it has manifested itself in many ways. Biden administration's vetoes of ceasefire resolutions in the UN Security Council, which drew widespread condemnation from pro-Palestine groups, rekindled the debate about the Zionist influence, raising the issue of dominance of Zionist Jews in the U.S. administration and policy circles is often seen through the prism of anti-Semitism in the West, even though the same people paradoxically like to boast about the disproportionate number of Jews in other fields. The Zionist Jewishness of Biden's cabinet was pointed out recently by The Forward, a progressive media for a Jewish American audience, as well as the Israeli right-wing newspaper Times of Israel. Being a Jew should not be seen as a problem, but those in the Biden administration have clearly exhibited the tendencies of Zionism, not only justifying the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza, but also lobbying for more financial and military aid to the occupying regime. There are also non-Jewish Zionists whose support is motivated by Christian Zionism or belonging to pro-Israel lobbies, a common case in the ranks of the Republican Party. The problem lies in the fact that everyone in the Biden administration is a radical Zionist who will uncompromisingly justify the Zionist regime's war crimes, with slight disagreements over relatively minor issues, such as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In the American mainstream media, voting in the UN Security Council and supporting the genocidal destruction of Gaza is treated as common sense and a natural course of action. Biden made no secret of his Zionist inclinations, uttering the words, "I am a Zionist," and he has proved it through numerous pro-Israeli activities in his decades-long political career. One of them is the placement of Jewish Zionists in top positions in his administration, which at the beginning of 2021 evoked a popular joke on social networks that the West Wing would have a minion. The Hebrew term minion means the minimum number of males required to constitute a representative community of Israel for liturgical purposes. Biden's initial lineup includes Antony Blinken as Secretary of State, Merrick Garland as Attorney General, Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence, Ronald Klain as White House Chief of Staff, Rachel Levine as Assistant Secretary for Health, Alejandro Mayorkas as Secretary of Homeland Security, and Janet Yellen as Secretary of Treasury. One level down are David Cohen as Deputy CIA Director, Eric Lander as Science and Technology Advisor, Anne Noberger as Deputy National Security Advisor, and Wendy Sherman as Deputy Secretary of State. In the meantime, Victoria Nuland took the position of Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs, Ed Siskel as White House Counsel, and Klain was replaced by Jeff Zients as Chief of Staff. Others appointed by Biden include Ned Price as a spokesperson for the Department of State, Jennifer Klain as Executive Director of the White House Gender Policy Council, as well as a large number of ambassadors. The Zionist envoys include Michael Alder, David Cohen, Rahem Emanuel, Eric Garcetti, Mark Gainstein, Amy Gutman, Jonathan Kaplan, Yael Lempert, Alan Leventhal, Randy Levine, Jack Liu, Jack Markell, Constance Milstein, Mark Nathanson, Mark Ostfield, David Pressman, Daniel Rosenblum, and Mark Stanley, among others. Blinken, the top American diplomat, comes from a Zionist family. His grandfather, Morris, was one of the early American Zionists and the founder of the American-Palestine Institute in the years before the declaration of the Zionist entity. His institute funded economists to prepare a report on the economic viability of such an entity and lobbied Washington to politically support its creation. Following Blinken's appointment as the top U.S. diplomat, replacing Mike Pompeo, the Zionist regime media praised his and Biden's close relations with Tel Aviv during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, noting their lifeline support for Israel and its security. During the Obama administration, Blinken often justified Zionist regime's aggressions in the region with the backney phrase, the right to self-defense, and praised Trump for strengthening the Zionist regime's regional alliances. He was a close confidant of the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer, who could call him in the middle of the night for pro-Israeli services, such as lobbying hard to have Israel's Iron Dome air military system financed with American taxpayer money. In his first days in office, he also made it known that the new Biden administration would support earlier Trump's decision and keep the American embassy to the occupied territories in the occupied Al-Quds. Last year, during the bickering between Biden and Netanyahu, Blinken pledged enduring U.S. ties with the Zionist regime, seeing it as a far more important ally than NATO member Turkey. As for Mayor Kass, even the Israeli media boasted of his strong family ties to Tel Aviv and praised him for the data-sharing pact between the United States and the Zionist regime. Even greater Zionist credit for intelligence sharing goes to CIA Deputy Chief David Cohen, whose career under Obama focused on sanctioning Israel's enemies. Thus, it is no surprise that Americans are bankrolling the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza while harping about ceasefire and aid drops to hoodwink the international community.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we talked to a man that defied all odds after he was seriously injured during a gun and bomb attack that killed three of his fellow band members in July 1975. Going on to become a beacon of reconciliation, my next guest has embodied the essence of the Irish peace process. So let's introduce today's guest. Joining me today is Steve Travers, a former bass guitarist in the Miami Showband. Steve survived a horrific attack by the loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Volunteer Force, that took the lives of his three friends and bandmates. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean. It's nice to be here.
Now, I usually begin by asking the generic question of your childhood growing up, but I would like to get to the crux of our conversation today, which is the story of what had happened on the 31st of July 1975.
Sure. Well, like most young fellows growing up in the 60s, we all wanted to be the Beatles. We wanted to join the Beatles and be pop stars. And as far as living, I was living down in Carrick and Shore in South Tipperary, so as far as the the North was concerned, it may as well have been the North Pole. To my shame, we say that now. But I started playing, and it was the easiest thing that I ever did. It was easier than having a real job. And so I was headhunted by a number of bands, and one of them was the Miami Show Band. The band was a huge band. It had been going for a long time, but they changed the lineup over the years. You know, people used to come and go. It was an institution, really, that band. Our lead singer, Fran O'Toole, was archetypical sort of pop star. And the band was also doing its own material. So it was an attractive thing for me to join that band and hit the ground running, really, in start of June 1975. And we were, being the summertime, we would have been playing 6-7 nights a week. Anne and I had just, we'd been married the year before. You know, it's almost like a honeymoon period when you join a band like that, and you get to know new friends, and everybody is friendly. And we were, I always like to emphasize the fact that we were a mixed band. We were Catholics and Protestants from North and South, although I had no idea who was, you know, I mean, obviously the accents would give the likes of Ray and Des and Brian away, because clearly they were from the North. But with regard to religion or politics or anything, I had no idea what anybody was, you know. And we were playing, and I remember that particular weekend, last weekend, really, in July 75, we'd been playing at the Galway Races. And we had been playing there. We played there on the Monday and the Tuesday. When we got home after the two nights, we would normally have the Tuesday off, but because we were playing on the Monday and Tuesday, the night that we were due to have off, we'd like to have one night off a week, but the night we were due to have off was the Thursday night. But we still had one gig to do, and that was in Banbridge, in County Down, just north of Newry. There was plans already set in motion to try to frame the band, the members of the band, as running guns, basically, or bombs, or whatever it was, for the IRA. So we would have been, it was a false flag operation, obviously. And we finished the dance. Ray went home to Antrim in his own car, because we had the following night off, the Thursday night off. So there's five of us got back into the minibus. We had a Volkswagen minibus for the personnel. We didn't travel with the equipment. The only equipment we carried was our guitar. So Tony Geraghty and I, Tony was the lead player, I was the bass player, and we carried our equipment. Sometimes we would have brought Des Lee, as he called himself, his saxophone with him. And we, that was the case that night. So it was Tony's guitar, my guitar, and Des's guitar. And if you know the way they're constructed, those Volkswagen minibuses, there's the engine is in the back, and there's a little shelf at the back, so you can lift a window over the engine. And there was a little shelf, and that's where we used to put those instruments. We wouldn't give our guitars to the roadie, because roadies are inclined to throw stuff into the van, and you know, it's a bit like somebody working in an airline, you know, with your case, you couldn't be sure. So we were precious about them, and we were in good form, because it's a relatively short journey from Banbridge to Dublin. We were based in Dublin, and normally some of the lads, if it's a longish journey, the lads would be nodding off after a while, you know. And I was a bit of an insomniac, so I would always sit up beside Brian McCoy, who was our trumpet player. And Brian was always drove the personnel van as well. He kept it at home, and but because everybody was wide awake, and they had no intention of sleeping on the way home, I climbed back into the back to chat with Tony. We were talking about guitars. We're about 6 miles from north of Newry at this time. We weren't long out of Banbridge. Brian turned back to us and said, we've got to stop. There's a roadblock. And you'd come across these. In 1975, the troubles were raging. So we knew the drill. At least the lads, I was the least experienced traveling in the north and with stops and roadblocks, but the lads knew the drill, and I got to know them very quickly. You stopped, turned on your interior lights, you turned off your main lights, you let your side lights on, and you approached when you're told to approach. There was a man with a red torch. On this particular time, we were surprised that Brian said, almost apologetically, he was a real gentleman, Brian, and he said, we've got to get out. These gentlemen want to do a check on the van. And for me, being the new recruit from way down south in South Tipperary, you know, I thought this was a big adventure. It was. You know, it was something that, you know, go home and tell Anne, you know what, we were stopped with by a man with a gun or whatever, you know. But there's a sliding door on the side of the Volkswagen minibus. You just pull it across, and the lads piled out, and I was the last one out. As I got out, I noticed that there was a number of soldiers there. Now, I wouldn't have known one uniform from another, but these were all sort of a darkish type of uniform, and apparently this was UDR uniforms that they were wearing. And some of the men were hunkered down. They were all friendly, to be honest with you. And they told us to line up facing the hedge. And at the hedge, there was a drop of about 3 meters down into the field in front of us. And they told us to put our hands on our heads. It was just, you know, intertwine your fingers and put your hands on. Yeah, this was just adding to the adventure for me. And as I say, there was five of us. Ray was gone home. So I was in the middle. And Tony Geraghty, our guitar player, was on my left. And Fran was on his left. And then on my right, Des McAlay, Des Lee was on. Brian McCoy was on my right, and Des was on his right. And Des was in, you know, touching distance of the back of the van. That's how close we were to it. And there was banter between the soldiers and ourselves, and they were saying, one of them said, I bet you lads would rather be at home in bed than standing out here at the side of the road. And Fran O'Toole, our singer, was a witty fella, and he said, I bet you lads would rather be at home in bed than sitting in a ditch, because some of them were hunkering down. And I was fascinated by the guns they had, these sort of rifles with perforated barrels. I think they were submachine guns or something like that. And one was laying across this man's legs, and as I say, he was hunkered down. There was another man who seemed to be in charge, and he was giving the orders, and there was another man there, the man that I think he may have been the person that stopped us and told us to pull in. He had a notebook, and just before we pulled in, there was a car coming up behind us, and when he told us to get out, Brian said, can I pull into the side of the road? There's a car coming up fast behind us. And he told us, yeah, that's fine. So we're standing there, and everything was very relaxed. And the man in charge told the man with the notebook to get our names and addresses. And so he started at Fran, and he asked Fran his name and address, and Fran was giving it to him. He was about to ask Tony his name, and another man appeared on the scene, and I hadn't seen him, no. I'm not sure if he arrived in the car that was pulling up, coming up behind us, because that particular car never passed us. And but this man, when he arrived, everything changed. The atmosphere changed, and he had a lighter colour fatigues on him, and it was actually fascinating because he had a sidearm. And he had a lighter colour beret, a fawn colour beret, as opposed to the green ones that the other men were had. And he asked the man who appeared to be in charge what the man with the notebook was doing. And the minute he started to talk, I recognised, you know, this is an Englishman. And the men that were hunkered down were standing up now, and everybody was. It appeared as if they were more professional. And this man definitely took charge. And I was just fascinated by this soldier who was made everything that bit sort of more professional. And as I say, Brian McCoy was standing beside me, and he nudged my elbow with his, and he said, "This is British Army." And what he meant was that, you know, this would be done professionally. And I heard a click. They had opened the back of our van, that little shelf, and I heard a click. This was just before the man arrived. I heard this click, and they were opening the guitar cases. And I'll tell you how, you know, I didn't take it seriously. I took my hands down, and I turned around, and I walked back to the back of the minibus. And I said to him, "Can I help you with that?" I didn't want them touching. I had a very unusual guitar. It was called a Dan Armstrong bass. It was a plexiglass. You could see through it. It was like a glass bass. And there was only about four of them in the country. Phil Innes had one. Brush Shields had one. I had one. There was about four of us had them. And we were precious about them, you know. And so there was two men at the back, and they pointed at a little case. I had a little brown school case type thing, and they said, "What's in that?" I said, "It's effects pedals." It was unusual enough for a bass player to be using effects pedals in '75, but I had a wah-wah pedal and an octave divider, which was called a color sound octavider, and he said, "Are there any valuables in them?" And I said, "No." I was surprised that he would even ask that. But in hindsight, I think maybe he was asking where the, you know, was the take for the money from the gig or something. I don't know what he meant, but we wouldn't have been carrying that. The roadie would have done all that. And when I said no, he turned me around and punched me in the back and knocked me back into line. But this time, instead of being in the middle, I was next to Des. It was between Des and Brian. So I was second from the van. Brian was reassuring me, and he nudged me, and he said, "This is British Army, we'll be away soon." And he actually said British Army, which was important, because later on we were able to verify that. And Des chirped in as well, and both of these lads are from the north. Des is from Belfast and Brian's from Caledon, and they would have grown up and know the, you know, different accents as well, and with trained musicians' ears they would know that this is, you know, this is British Army. But and he also said, Des said, the army is usually careful with the equipment. So that was a comforting thing. What we didn't know was that there were two men had taken a 10-pound bomb, commercial explosives, and they were putting it under the driver's seat. For years we thought that this thing was placed in the back, which was actually, they were placing it under the driver's seat. And the plan was that we wouldn't know anything about this bomb that they were putting under the thing, and they would have said, "Thanks very much for your cooperation." We would have driven off, and according to forensics, it would have gone off between 10 and 15 minutes after we left. So nobody would have known about the roadblock. And we would have been, people would have said, "Well, these fellows were carrying bombs, maybe for the IRA or whatever, and so who can we trust?" And they would have put pressure then on the Irish government to have shut down, basically have more stringent security on the border, because at the time, you know, if the IRA had maybe, there was some sort of an outrage and they would have crossed over the border, they were reasonably safe, because not because the Irish government wanted it like that, but because the TDs along the border counties didn't want to disrupt the normal life of people who would have been crossing the border on a daily basis for maybe petrol or groceries, which might have been cheaper at the, you know, on the northern side. And so that was the reluctance. It wasn't for anything else. And but it didn't work. The plan didn't work. They were using a wristwatch timing mechanism. And for one reason or another, maybe they tilted it the wrong way. I don't know anything about these bombs, but this thing exploded. And the two unfortunate men that were planting this bomb, or if they were blown to pieces, you know, they tore the head off one person, the legs off and the arms off another, but there was very little left of them, you know. I remember seeing the autopsy reports, and they were shocking, the damage. But when it went off, as I say, we were standing right beside it, and you know, the pictures, there are pictures all over the place of the wreckage. I mean, there was little or nothing left, and it lifted me up into the air. And I remember, you know, being aware that something was happening, and I often say that the whole world turned red. It actually, that's what it looked like to me, and maybe it was the flames or whatever. And I tried to run, but I was in the air, so I couldn't get any purchase on my feet, you know. And I could hear guns going off. It was like as if I was in slow motion. I was just raised up into the air, and then I started to go down through the ditch. As I say, there was about a 3-meter drop into the field. And as I was going down through the ditch, I felt almost like time was coming to a stop. And even through my clothes, I could count every single leaf and bramble and every single thing that I was touching. Now, whether that's a heightened awareness from adrenaline or something, I don't know. But I was very aware of all of that. And then all of a sudden, time went back to normal, and I hit the ground very hard. And instantly, there was two more people fell on top of me. And I think it may well have been Tony and Fran. Now, Des was blown through a separate, there was trees, and he was blown separately off a bit to the right. So there was, the two lads fell on top of me. And somebody then put their hands under my arm. Apparently, I was shot while I was in the air. I didn't realize I was shot, but I was shot with what they call a dum-dum bullet, which is specifically designed to explode on impact. And it hit me just over my right hip, and when it entered my body, it exploded into 17 pieces. So it was these things explode when they, and it did a lot of internal damage, and then part of it continued on, and it through my left lung and out under my left arm, so it went right across the body. And somebody put their hands under my arms and started to drag me, maybe to try to get me to stand up, but I was a dead weight at that stage. And and while he was, I'm very reluctant to say it was Brian. I'm pretty certain it was Brian McCoy. And the reason I'm reluctant to say it is because I feel guilty that he was murdered dragging me, trying to drag me away from the thing. And he was a Protestant lad from Caledon in County Tyrone, and I'm a Catholic from South Tipperary, and he's dragging me out, trying to drag me away from what's happening. And he was shot in the head and the back, and because the soldiers jumped down after us and started to kill everybody, started to shoot everybody. And so Brian was lying beside me, and I was lying on the ground, and I kept my face to the side. I always remember that my cheek and the grass, just lying down wondering what was happening. And I could hear the others, the soldiers then caught up with Fran and Tony, and they didn't get very far. They tried to run away, but I could hear the crying and the begging for, you know, and Fran was lying on the ground, and he was facing them, and he's, you know, asking them not to kill him, and they stood over him, and they shot Fran, our singer, 22 times, and 7 of those were in the face. He was a particularly good-looking young lad, you know, and shot Tony in the back of the head, and a number of times as well. And one of the things that stands out for me was the obscenities, the cursing and the swearing, the shouting and roaring of the soldiers, like real anger, you know. That was quite frightening, you know. And when the shooting stopped, then I could hear at least one soldier was walking around, and he was firing into the bodies, to make sure they were dead, but they were well dead. And he walked over, and Brian was lying beside me. Brian was dead as well, and he started kicking Brian ferociously. He was like giving, really kicking into him, and shouting and screaming. And then he walked out, was like about 2 feet away from that, and he turned to me and he stood over me and will I get up? Will I beg? You know, will I ask him not to? But I had heard it didn't do the lads a lot of good, you know. So I just stayed quiet, and I thought he was going to fire into me. And I was saying to myself, it should be quick. And just as he stood over me and he had a pistol, somebody on the road shouted down, come on.